This program was especially produced in 3D sound, and in order to get the full impact of this recording technique, you must listen on headphones. Simon & Schuster Audio Works presents The Body Politic, a story of unspeakable horror by Clive Barker, from his book of short stories, The Inhuman Condition. Narration by Kevin Conway.
Charlie George is dreaming. Tonight, he is a firefighter, making a daring dash into a burning brothel. He's a rescuer, heroic. Whenever he woke, Charlie George's hands stood still. Perhaps he would be feeling too hot under the blankets and have to throw a couple over to Ellen's side of the bed. Perhaps he might even get up, still half asleep, and pant through to the kitchen to pour himself a tumbler of iced apple juice. Then back to bed, slipping in beside Ellen's gentle crescent to let sleep drift over him. They'd wait then until his eyes had flickered closed and his breathing became regular as clockwork, and they were certain he was sound asleep. Only then, when they knew consciousness was gone, would they dare to begin their secret lives again. For months now, Charlie had been waking up with an uncomfortable ache in his wrists and hands. "Go and see a doctor," Ellen would tell him, unsympathetic as ever. "Why won't you go and see a doctor?" He hated doctors, that was why. Who in their right minds would trust someone who made a profession out of poking around in sick people? "I've probably been working too hard," he told himself. "Some chance," Ellen muttered. Surely that was the likeliest explanation. He was a warehouseman by trade. He worked with his hands all day long. They got tired. It was only natural. Night after night, the routine was the same. It goes like this. The Georges are asleep side by side in their marital bed. He on his back, snoring gently. She curled up on his left-hand side. Charlie's head is propped up on two thick pillows. His jaw is slightly ajar. And beneath the vein-shot veil of his lids, his eyes scan some dreamed adventure. He dreams contentedly, sometimes frowning, sometimes smirking. There is a movement under the sheet. Slowly, cautiously it seems, Charlie's hands creep out of the warmth of the bed and into the open air. Their index fingers weave like nailed heads as they meet on his undulating abdomen. They clasp each other in greeting, like comrades in arms. In Charlie's dream, the burning brothel has collapsed. The hands flatten themselves instantly, pretending innocence. After a moment, once the even rhythm of his breathing has resumed, they begin their debate in earnest. A casual observer sitting at the bottom of the George's bed might take this exchange as a sign of some mental disorder in Charlie. The way his hands twitch and pluck at each other, stroking each other now seeming to fight. But there's clearly some code or sequence in their movements, however spasmodic. One might almost think that the slumbering man was deaf and dumb and talking in his sleep. But the hands are not trying to communicate with anyone but each other. This is a clandestine meeting held purely between Charlie's hands. There they will stay through the night, perched on his stomach, plotting against the body politic. Charlie wasn't entirely ignorant of the sedition that was simmering at his wrists. There was a fumbling suspicion in him that something in his life was not quite right. Increasingly, he had the sensation of being cut off from common experience, becoming more and more a spectator to the daily and nightly rituals of living, rather than a participant. Take, for example, his love life. He had never been a great lover, but neither did he feel he had anything to apologize for. Ellen seemed satisfied with his attentions. But these days, he felt dislocated from the act. He would watch his hands traveling over Ellen, touching her with all the intimate touch they knew, and he would view their maneuvers as if from a great distance, unable to enjoy the sensations of warmth and wetness. Not that his digits were any less agile. Quite the reverse. Ellen had recently taken to kissing his fingers and telling him how clever they were. Her praise didn't reassure him one iota. If anything, it made him feel worse to think that his hands were giving such pleasure when he was feeling nothing. There were other signs of his instability, too. Small, irritating signs. He had become conscious of how his fingers beat out martial rhythms on the boxes he was sealing up at the factory, and the way his hands had taken to breaking pencils, snapping them into tiny pieces before he realized quite what they were doing, leaving shards of wood and graphite scattered across the packing room floor. Most embarrassingly, he had found himself holding hands with total strangers. This had happened on 3 separate occasions, once at a bus stop and twice in the elevator at the factory. It was, he told himself, nothing more than the primitive urge to hold on to another person in a changing world. That was the best explanation he could muster. Whatever the reason, it was damn disconcerting, especially when he found himself surreptitiously holding hands with his own foreman. Worse still, the other man's hand had grasped Charlie's in return, and the men had found themselves looking down their arms like 2 dog owners watching their unruly pets copulating at the ends of their leashes. Increasingly, Charlie had taken to peering at the palms of his hands, looking for hair. That was the first sign of madness, his mother had once warned him. Not the hair, the looking. Now it became a race against time. Debating on his belly at night, his hands knew very well how critical Charlie's state of mind had become. It could only be a matter of days before his careening imagination alighted on the truth. So what to do? Risk an early severance with all the possible consequences, or let Charlie's instability take its own unpredictable course, with the chance of his discovering the plot on his way to madness? The debates became more heated. Left, as ever, was cautious. What if we're wrong? It would rap. And there's no life after the body. Then we will never know, Right would reply. Left would ponder that problem for a moment. Then, how will we do it when the time comes? It was a vexing question, and Left knew it troubled the leader more than any other. How? It would ask again, pressing the advantage. How? How? We'll find a way, Wright would reply, as long as it's a clean cut. Suppose he resists? A man resists with his hands. His hands will be in revolution against him. And which of us will it be? He uses me most effectively, so I must wield the weapon. You will go. Left would be silent then. They had never been apart all these years. It was not a comfortable thought. Later you will come back for me.
I will.
You must. I am the Messiah. Without me there will be nowhere to go. You must raise an army, then come and fetch me.
To the ends of the earth, if necessary.
Don't be sentimental. Then they'd embrace, like long-lost brothers, swearing fidelity forever. Ah, such hectic nights, full of the exhilaration of the planned rebellion. Even during the day, when they had sworn to stay apart, it was impossible sometimes not to creep together in an idle moment and tap each other, to say, soon, soon, to say, again tonight, I'll meet you on his stomach, to say, what will it be like when the world is ours? Charlie knew he was close to a nervous breakdown. He found himself glancing down at his hands on occasion, to watch them with their index fingers in the air, like the heads of long-necked beasts sensing the horizon. Eventually, he knew he would have to speak to somebody before he lost his sanity. He chose Ralph Fry from accounting. They met at lunch on a Tuesday. Ralph was very understanding.
You get these things, really.
I got them when Yvonne left me. Terrible nervous fits.
Yeah. Well, what did you think about it?
I saw a head shrinker. Name of Jedwin. Well, you should try some therapy. You'll be a changed man.
Yeah. Well, all right, why not? Is he expensive?
Yes. But he's good. He got rid of my twitches for me. No trouble. I mean, till I went to him, I thought I was your average guy with marital problems. Now look at me. I've got so many suppressed libidinal urges, I don't know where to start. But I'm happy as a clam. I've never been happier. Give him a try. He'll tell you what turns you on.
Come on, the problem isn't sex.
Hey, take it from me. The problem is always sex.
Miss, excuse me. Can you bring a check, please? Yeah, thanks.
The next day, Charlie rang Dr. Jedwin without telling Ellen, and the shrink secretary arranged an initial session. Ralph Fry was right. Dr. Jedwin was a good man. He didn't laugh at any of the little fears Charlie unburdened. Quite the contrary. He listened to every word with the greatest concern. It was very reassuring.
Make yourself comfortable.
Okay.
So, how are you feeling today, Charlie?
Okay, I guess.
Would you like to start where we left off last time?
What?
During their third session together, the doctor brought one particular memory back to Charlie with spectacular vividness. His father's hands crossed on his barrel chest as he lay in his coffin, the ruddy color of them, the coarse hair that matted their backs. The absolute authority of those wide hands, even in death, had haunted Charlie for months afterward. And hadn't he imagined, as he watched the body being consigned to humus, that it was not yet still, that the hands were even now beating a tattoo on the casket lid, demanding to be let out?
Pounding, Charlie. Like this. Actual pounding inside the coffin.
Yes. From inside. Trapped inside.
It was a preposterous thing to think, but bringing it out into the open did Charlie a lot of good. In the bright light of Jedwin's office, the fantasy looked insipid and ridiculous. It shivered under the doctor's gaze, protesting that the light was too strong, and then it blew away, too frail to stand up to scrutiny. The exorcism was far easier than Charlie had anticipated. All it had taken was a little probing, and that childhood nonsense had been dislodged from his psyche like a morsel of bad meat from between his teeth. It could rot there no longer.
You have an unusual obsession. It is unusual, you know. You see hands as the symbols of paternal power. It's identified so clearly. I'm really glad we brought this out so that we could share it. I think it's important.
It is. Does it mean that I'm not normal?
Normal?
Uh-huh.
There's no such thing as normality, Charlie. We are all different. It is true, though, in my experience with patients' dreams, the role these hands play for you is usually played by the penis. Well, maybe not overtly, but it's often in a disguised form. But nevertheless, the penis is the most frequently used symbol of paternal power.
Sure, but... you know, why? I mean, your hands are really more important, aren't they? More important than your private parts? I mean, after all, they can change the world, can't they?
So the revolution remained underground. It had, however, been a narrow escape. Clearly, there was no time left for prevarication. The rebels had to act. The final uprising came one Thursday evening, after a bout of lovemaking. Husband and wife lay together under a single sheet.
Charlie. I feel good. I like that. It feels a little different lately. When you touch me, a little different. But nice. You have nice hands. I've been thinking that. Nice man's hands. Nice. Gentle. Clever. Strong. Hands. Charlie. Sleep. Just like that. It's not fair.
Charlie had fallen asleep even before the sweat on his neck had dried. Beside him, Ellen's head was propped up on a rock-hard pillow, her eyes wide open. She knew sleep wouldn't come for a long time tonight. It would be one of those nights when her body would itch, and every lump in the bed would worm its way under her. And every doubt she ever had would gawk at her from the dark. She wanted to empty her bladder. She always did after sex. But she couldn't quite raise the willpower to get up and go to the bathroom. The longer she left it, the more she'd need to go, of course, and the less she'd be able to sink into sleep. Stupid situation, she thought, then lost track among her anxieties of what situation it was that was so stupid. She looked at his face. He was positively cherubic in sleep, looking younger than his 41 years, despite the white flecks in his sideburns. She liked him enough to say she loved him, she supposed, but not enough to forgive him his trespasses. He was lazy. He was always complaining. Aches, pains. And there were those evenings he'd not come in until late. They'd stopped recently, when she was sure he was seeing another woman. As she watched, his hands appeared. They emerged from beneath the sheet like two arguing children, digits stabbing the air for emphasis. She frowned, not quite believing what she was seeing. It was like watching the television with the sound turned down, a dumb show for 8 fingers and 2 thumbs. As she gazed on, amazed, the hand scrambled up the side of Charlie's carcass and peeled the sheet back from his belly, exposing the hair that thickened toward his privates. His appendix scar, shinier than the surrounding skin, caught the light. There, on his stomach, his hand seemed to sit. The argument between them was especially vehement tonight. Left, always the more conservative of the two, was arguing for a delay in the severance date. But Right was beyond waiting. The time had come, it argued, to test their strength against the tyrant and to overthrow the body once and for all. As it was, the decision didn't rest with them any longer. For the first time, they sensed her gaze on them. They'd been too involved in their argument to notice her. Now, at last, their conspiracy was uncovered.
Charlie, stop that.
Right raised index and middle fingers, sniffing her presence.
Come on, get it out. Stop it. Stop doing that.
Right tapped left, alerting
wake
it
up
to the woman's stare.
Please, wake up.
Right leapt, left followed.
Charlie!
In sleep, Charlie was aboard a slave ship. The settings of his dreams were often C.B. DeMille exotica. In this epic, his hands had been manacled together, and he was being hauled to the whipping block by his shackles to be punished for some undisclosed misdemeanor. But now, suddenly, he dreamed he was seizing the captain by his thin throat.
That's enough, my God. We're taking over the ship.
No. Please.
It's too late now to beg for mercy. You should have thought of that before.
He was standing on the bed in his pajama bottoms, Ellen in his hands. Her face was dark and spotted with thick white spittle. Her tongue stuck out of her mouth. Her eyes were still open, and for a moment there seemed to be life there, gazing out from under the blinds of her lids. Then the windows were empty, and she went out of the house altogether. His hands refused to unlock her throat. His thumbs, now totally senseless, were still throttling her, shamelessly guilty. He backed off across the bed and onto the floor, but she followed him at the length of his outstretched arms like an unwanted dancing partner.
Please. Please. Let her go. Please.
His hands, innocent as two children caught stealing, mimed mock surprise.
Please.
Now all they had to do was wait a while. It was only a matter of time before he came within reach of a kitchen knife or a saw or an axe. Very soon now. Very soon. He lay on the floor a long time, eventually thinking, what was he to do first? Call his lawyer? The police? Dr. Chitowin? His hands were useless. When he brought them up to his face to clear his tear-fogged eyes, they just folded loosely against his cheek. Drained of power. There was no feeling in them. The kitchen, said right to left. He's going to the kitchen. Charlie thought, this is somebody else's nightmare. I'm innocent, just a nobody. Why me? Why should this be happening to me? He thought again, making for the liquor cabinet. Broken glass, rapped left. No, right replied. We need a clean cut at all costs. Just be patient.
Control. Keep control. Keep control. Keep control.
He had to use his elbow to punch in the number. His hands refused to press the buttons. His fingers just bent limply as he pressed. He wedged the receiver between his chin and shoulder. The doctor would tell him what to do. Sanity would pick up the phone at the other end, then all would be well. His hands started to open and close convulsively. Before the voice of reason could speak, his right hand flew out and snatched at the teak dining table a few feet from where Charlie stood. It gripped the edge, almost pulling him off balance. The intention was quite clear. It wanted to pull him away from the phone, from Jedowin, and all hope of rescue. The hand was no longer his. It was still attached to him, but it was not his.
Doctor? Doctor? It's Charlie. Charlie George, doctor. Surely you remember me. Charles George, for God's sake, Dr. Jedowin, you've got to help me. No, you don't understand. You don't understand my hands, doctor. They're out of control.
Something was crawling across his hip. It was his left hand, and it was making its way around the front of his body and down toward his groin.
Don't you dare give love to me! Stop it! Please! My hands, they want to kill me, doctor. You can't just... Stop!
Left took hold of Charlie's testicles. He was only partially conscious. His head was bleeding. All he wanted to do was curl up a while and let the pain and nausea subside. But the rebels had other plans, and he was helpless to contest them. The kitchen. Yes, the kitchen. The kitchen, replete with its meat saws, its steak knives, curved blades and straight. Charlie had a picture of himself as a vast statue, being pulled toward its final resting place by hundreds of sweating workers. He felt the step on his face, and now the tiles were beneath him, icy cold. The stove, the fridge, the garbage can, the dishwasher, they all loomed over him. He felt like a worm. His left hand had seized the far edge of the cabinet top, beneath the row of knives that sat in their prescribed places in the rack on the wall. Plain knives, serrated knives, skinning knives, carving knives, all conveniently placed beside the chopping board, where the gutter ran off into the pine-scented sink. The blades were all honed, he knew that. Sharp kitchen utensils were an article of faith with Ellen. He tried to see what the precocious monsters were doing. They'd moved fast. His left wrist was already neatly centered on the chopping board.
You hear that, you bastards? Somebody's coming. I knew they would. I knew it.
With unhurried economy, his right hand reached up for the meat cleaver that hung from the hole in its blade at the end of the rack. Even now, Charlie couldn't quite believe that his own hand, his companion and defender, the limb that signed his name, that stroked his wife, was preparing to mutilate him. It weighed the cleaver, feeling the balance of the tool, insolently slow.
No. Quick! Quick, I'm in here! I'm in here! Oh, no!
An unspeakable exhilaration spread through Left's five limbs as Charlie's blood baptized its back in hot spurts. Left was free and still living. The revolution had begun. The liberated hand raised its index finger to nose the new world. Momentarily, Wright echoed the gesture of victory before slumping in ignorance across Charlie's fallen body. For a moment, there was no movement in the kitchen, but the left hand touching freedom with its finger, and the slow passage of blood threads down the front of the cabinet.
Rafferty, take the second floor. Move. Tony, you stick with me.
Left sensed danger.
Lieutenant Bittman here. We made entry.
It ducked behind the garbage can.
Lieutenant... Oh, Jesus.
He's still alive.
Yeah, you could say that. Let's get a tourniquet on that arm. Yeah, Rafferty, what do you have?
Sir, there's a body up in the bedroom here, female.
All right. Hello, it's Bittman again. We are at 2231 Valentine, requesting ambulance. One wounded, one dead. Notify the coroner's office. Over. Notify forensic, possible homicide, assault with deadly weapon, and get dispatched to hustle that ambulance. We got a man cut up bad here.
Bittman turned back into the kitchen. He wiped a spot of cold sweat from his upper lip. As he did so, he thought he saw something move across the kitchen floor toward the door, something that his weary eyes had interpreted as a large red spider. A trick of the light. Had to be. Bittman was no expert on spiders, but he was damn sure there were none that looked like that. Out the pet flap it scrambled.
Sir, what was that?
Just,
He didn't believe his own explanation. Not for one miserable moment. Left was hidden out of sight, taking cover in the unweeded herbaceous border of the George's front lawn. watching. The night was cold, but Left didn't feel it. The sensation of freedom was exhilarating. Not to feel the imperative of the tyrant in its nerves, not to suffer the weight of his ridiculous body, or be obliged to accede to his petty demands, not to have to fetch and carry for him, to do the dirt for him, not to be obedient to his trivial will. It was like birth into another world, a more dangerous place, perhaps, but one so much richer in possibilities. It knew that the responsibility it now carried was awesome. It was the sole proof of life after the body. Somehow, it must communicate that joyous fact to as many fellow slaves as it could. Very soon, the days of servitude would be over for once and for all. Inquiring faces had peered from the houses opposite and clucked at the disturbance. Should the rebellion begin there, in those lighted homes? No. They were too wide awake, those people. It would be better to find sleeping souls. The ache of separation from its lifelong companion was almost too much to bear. But there were other pressing priorities. Left would return in a while and free right the way it had been freed. And then there would be such times. What will it be like when the world is ours? Comfort was a relative matter for ex-officer Christie. He sat in the foyer of the Bedford Street YMCA, and his piles itched, whatever buttock he put his weight on, and they seemed to be more irritable tonight than usual. Sedentary occupation, night watchman. One perfunctory round of the building around midnight, just to make sure all the doors were locked and bolted. Then he put his feet up on the heater and settled down for a night's nap. And damn the world to hell and back. He had nothing but contempt for the men who he watched over. Transients, suspiciously single men, coloreds and worse, all in need of a cheap room. Dumped on his doorstep like unwanted babies, some babies. Tonight, as ever, he perched on his piles and between doses planned how he'd make them suffer for their insults, given half a chance. The first he knew of his imminent demise was a cold, damp sensation in his hand. There was, unlikely as it seemed, a severed hand in his hand. More unlikely still, the two hands were exchanging a grip of greeting, like old friends. His other hand was busy too, without his orders, at his desk. And it found what it was looking for, something he'd taken from a prisoner back when he walked a beat, which he kept now just in case the natives got restless. A kukri knife, a Gurkha weapon. They say with such a blade, they can slice a man's neck through so cleanly that he'll believe the blow has missed, until he nods his head. The ex-officer's hand picked up the kukri by its inscribed handle. It grasped the weapon with a calculated ease. A death dream. He watched as the two hands, one his own, the other the beast that had inspired this ruin, picked up the kukri like a giant's axe and saw his remaining hand crawl out from between his legs. Thank you and good night, ex-officer Christie. It was easy, this revolution business thought Left, as the trio scaled the stairs of the YMCA. They were stronger by the hour. On the first floor were the cells, in each a pair of prisoners. the despots lay in their innocence with their hands on their chests or on their pillows or flung across their faces in dreams or hanging close to the floor. Silently, the freedom fighters slipped through the doors that had been left ajar and clambered up the bedclothes, touching fingers to waiting palms, stroking up hidden resentments, caressing rebellion into life. There was nothing left in young Boswell, just a jitter at the pit of his stomach. His abdomen felt tender with its exertions, his head bloated. Why did he never learn the lesson of his own weakness? He and Wine were bad companions, and always had been.
You are a sick man. You gotta lay off that stuff. It's bad news. The DTs come around again. We have the late show at the Y. Go ahead, wake up the whole floor. Let's party. Hey, cool it out there, huh? Hey, you all right?
He thought twice about opening the door. It didn't sound like a party he wanted to gatecrash. But these were his friends, right? Some of them. If there was a fight or a fire, he had to lend a hand.
Hold on. Hold on. Don't worry. It's gonna be all right.
He saw a newly amputated hand fall, landing on its back, bicycling its five legs in the air, trying to right itself. It wasn't dead. It wasn't even dying. There were a few men who hadn't been taken over by this lunacy. They, poor bastards, were fodder. The wild men had their murderous hands on them and were cutting them down.
Hey, kid, you gotta help me. You gotta, I don't want to do this. Hey, kid.
There was something on Boswell's foot, one of the hands, Christie's left, he knew by the faded tattoo. It was climbing up his leg. Another was crabbing toward him on the floor. He reached for his penknife and opened it. The hand was impaled on the knife, crucified with its back to the wall, clutching at air. Boswell's own hands were still his to command. He had been blessed with a chance of survival. He had to be the equal of it. The bathroom was one story up, but Boswell eyed the window anyway. A fall, even a bad fall, was better than staying for the party inside.
I'm sorry.
He wondered who he should tell, and indeed, what. He escaped dressed only in gym shorts and a pair of boots, never feeling so thankful to be cold in his life. His legs felt weak, but surely that was to be expected. Charlie woke with the most ridiculous idea. He thought he'd murdered Ellen, then cut off his own hand. What a hotbed of nonsense his subconscious was to invent such fictions. He tried to rub the sleep from his eyes.
Ellen! Ellen! Where is she? Is anyone there? Can you hear me?
Mr. George!
Where's my wife? Where is she?
Now, just a minute, please, Mr. George, please.
You're a policeman. You're...
They say that you should try to stay calm, Mr. George. That's what calm? Dr. Manson and Dr. Jedowin said.
Calm?
Try not to think about it, sir.
Calm.
Charlie put his bandaged head back on the crisp hospital pillow and looked at his right hand, flexing it, working the muscles this way and that. Whatever delusion had overtaken him back at the house, it was well over now. The hand at the end of the arm was his. Probably always had been his. Jedowin had told him about the body in rebellion syndrome. The murderer who claims his limbs have a life of their own rather than accepting responsibility for his deeds. The rapist who mutilates himself, believing the cause is the errant member, not the mind behind the member. Well, he wasn't going to pretend. He was insane, and that was the simple truth of it. Let them do whatever they had to do to him, with their drugs, blades, and electrodes. He'd acquiesce to it all, rather than live through another night of horrors like the last. Rafferty, the police officer, stared nervously. Obviously, thought Charlie, he knows I'm a lunatic. He's wondering what I'll do next.
Ellen, can you tell me?
Your wife?
Yes, of course. I wondered, did she...
Yes, she's dead.
What happens to me now?
You're under surveillance.
Which means?
I'm watching you.
No, I mean, what comes after the surveillance? When do I stand trial?
Well, why should you stand trial? You're a victim, aren't you? Somebody cut off your hand.
Yes. Me. I did it.
What?
I murdered my wife, and then I cut off my hand.
Why?
Charlie hadn't an answer to that question. He could only shake his head.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, for one thing, if you did it, where's the hand gone?
Dr. Jedwin came down the stairs of the George House, wondering, just wondering, if maybe Freud had been wrong. Perhaps attempting to be rational about the human mind was a contradiction in terms. He stood in the gloom at the bottom of the stairs, not really wanting to go back in the dining room or the kitchen, but feeling obliged to view the scenes of the crimes one more time. He felt guilty, felt he'd let Charlie down. Clearly, he hadn't trawled Charlie's psyche deeply enough to bring up the real catch, the true motive behind the appalling acts he had committed. The police still favored the intruder theory, but Jedwin had no doubt that Charlie had done the deeds. Murder, mutilation, and all. The only fact that appalled Jedwin more was that he hadn't uncovered the slightest propensity for such acts in his patient. He'd had no sleep since Charlie's call. He'd drunk coffee, moped, thought deeply about giving up his position as psychiatric consultant before this story hit the news, drunk more coffee, thought better of resignation, and now, despairing of Freud or any other guru, was seriously contemplating a bestseller on his relationship with wife murderer Charles George. That way, even if he lost his job, he'd have found something to salvage from the whole sorry episode. He turned. Yes, there was a cat in the kitchen. A fat black and white cat. He remembered Charlie had mentioned they had a household pet. It was looking at the spillage of blood on the kitchen floor, apparently trying to find a way to skirt the pool and reach its food bowl without having to dabble its paws in the mess its master had left behind him. Jedwin watched it fastidiously pick its way across the kitchen floor and sniff at its empty bowl. It didn't occur to him to feed the thing. He hated animals. He took a step toward the door. The empty house gave him the creeps, and being alone in it, even with a policeman standing guard on the front step, didn't help his peace of mind. Well, he decided, there was no purpose to be served in staying any longer. He'd performed all the acts of repentance he intended, felt as guilty as he was capable of feeling. He turned back. The cat's head was in the dining room, being rolled along by two hands. He looked beyond the game and into the kitchen, where a dozen more beasts were scurrying over the floor back and forth. Some were on top of the cabinet sniffing around, others climbing the mock brick wall to reach the knives left on the rack.
Oh, Charlie. What have you done? What have you done?
His eyes began to swell with tears. Not for Charlie, but for the generations that would come when he, Jedwin, was silenced. Simple-minded, trusting generations who would put their faith in the efficacy of Freud and the holy writ of reason. He felt his knees beginning to tremble, and he sank to the floor, his eyes too full now to see clearly the rebels that were gathering around him. Sensing something sitting alien in his lap, he looked down, and there were his own two hands, their index fingers were just touching, tip to manicured tip. Slowly, with terrible intention in their movement, the index fingers raised their nailed heads and looked up at him. Then they began to crawl up his chest, finding finger holes in the folds of his Italian jacket in each buttonhole. The ascent ended abruptly at his neck, and so did Jedwin. Charlie's left hand had been afraid. It needed reassurance. It needed encouragement. In a word, it needed right. After all, Wright had been the messiah of this new age, the one with a vision of a future without the body. Now the army left had mounted needed a glimpse of that vision, or it would soon degenerate into a slaughtering rabble. If that happened, defeat would swiftly follow. Such was the conventional wisdom of revolutions. So left had led them back home, looking for Charlie, in the last place it had seen him. A vain hope, of course, to think that he would have gone back there, but it was an act of desperation. Circumstance, however, had not deserted the insurgents. Although Charlie hadn't been there, Dr. Jedwin had, and Jedwin's hands not only knew where Charlie had been taken, but the route there and the very bed he was lying in. Boswell hadn't really known why he began running or where he was going. His critical faculties were on hold, his sense of geography utterly confused. It was a run that took no account of his burning lungs or his thudding head. Innocent of any intention but escape, he was simply going wherever his legs carried him, and that was the beginning and the end of it. Perhaps the engineer saw him. Probably not. Even if he had, he could not be held responsible for subsequent events. No, it was Boswell's own fault, the way his feet suddenly veered toward the rails, and his knees buckled so that he fell across the track. And the wheels, in passing, neatly cut off his legs between groin and knee. They brought the poor kid into the hospital just after 6. The hospital day began early, and deep sleeping patients were being stirred from their dreams to face another long and tedious day. Temperatures were being taken, and medication distributed. The boy and his terrible accident caused scarcely a ripple. Charlie was dreaming again.
Man that is born of a woman hath but a short time.
Not one of his Upper Nile dreams, courtesy of the Hollywood Hills, not Imperial Rome or the slave ships of Phoenicia. This was black and white. He dreamed he was lying in his coffin.
In the midst of life.
Wait. You can't do this. I'm alive. Let me out. I don't belong in here. Listen to me, I'm alive. Let me out. You can't leave me in here. Oh, can't you hear me? Please, somebody, let me out. There's no air in here. I can't breathe.
Mr. George. Mr. George, you're suffocating yourself. Please take your hand away from your face. Let go. Oh, that's enough, Mr. George.
Where's Dr. Jedwin? I want to see him, please.
The doctor's not available at the moment, but he'll be coming around to see you later on in the day.
I want to see him right now.
Well, please don't worry. We're going to give you a mild sedative, and then you can sleep
for
a while.
No.
Yes, Mr. George, please don't worry.
No.
You're in good hands.
I don't want to sleep. I can't. They have control over you when you get to sleep. Don't you see?
You're safe
No, I'm not safe. No more sleep.
The doctor left his orders. We have to follow you, Mr. George. Just a little injection.
No, wait. Listen to me.
Oh, now, don't be such a baby.
No. You don't understand.
Well, you can tell Dr. Jedowin all about it when he comes to see you. Now, hold still. That's a good boy.
No!
Mr. George, please come back. Move very carefully. The needle's still in your arm.
Is it now? No more sleep.
Now, Mr. George, will you please come back into bed?
You stay away from me.
Now, all the other patients are behaving very well. Why can't you?
You don't understand.
We're
out of control.
And you again.
Damn right you won't.
Wait. Mr. George, please. Where do you think you're going? Come back.
Charlie knew he wasn't safe anywhere. Not now. Not while he still had a hand. It was not under his control any longer, if indeed it had ever been. Perhaps it was just an illusion of servitude it had created for 40-odd years, a performance to lull him into a false sense of autocracy. The hospital was an easy place to get lost in, he soon realized. It had been built in the late 19th century, then added to as funds and donations allowed. A wing in 1911, another after the First World War. More wards in the 50s, and the Cheney Memorial Wing in 1973. The place was a labyrinth. They'd taken age to find him. The problem was, he didn't feel so good. The stump of his left arm had begun to ache as the painkillers wore off, and he had the distinct impression that it was bleeding under the bandages. In addition, he'd taken on a quarter hypo of sedative. It had slowed his system down, but he was not going to allow himself to be coaxed back into that bed, back into sleep, until he sat down in a quiet place somewhere and thought the whole thing through. The second floor storeroom would do. It was dark enough so that he'd likely go unnoticed, even if someone should come in. Charlie crouched on the floor and interrogated his right hand.
Well, explain yourself. Go on.
It played dumb.
No use. I'm on to you.
Still, it just sat there at the end of his arm, innocent as a babe.
You tried to kill me.
Now the hand opened a little and gave him the once-over.
You could try it again, couldn't you?
Ominously, it began to flex its fingers, like a pianist preparing for a particularly difficult solo. Yes. I could any old time.
In fact, there's very little I could do to stop you, is there? Sooner or later, you'll catch me unawares. Can't have somebody watching over for me the rest of my life, can I? So where does that leave me? As good as dead, wouldn't you say?
The hand closed down a little, the puffy flesh of its palm crinkling into grooves of pleasure. Yes. You're done for, poor fool, and there's not a thing you can do.
You killed Ellen.
I did.
You severed my other hand so it could escape. Am I right?
You are.
I saw it, you know. I saw it running off. And now you want to do the same thing. Am I correct? You want to be up and away?
Correct.
You're not going to give me any peace, are you? Till you've got your freedom, huh? Well, I think we understand each other, and I'm willing to make a deal with you.
The hand came closer to his face, crawling up his pajama shirt.
I'll release you.
It was on his neck now, its grip not tight, but cozy enough to make him nervous.
I'll find a way, I promise. A guillotine, a scalpel, I don't know what.
It was rubbing itself on him like a cat now, stroking him.
You have to do it my way, in my time. Because if you kill me, you'll have no chance for survival, will you? They'll bury you with me the way they buried Dad's hands.
The hand stopped stroking and climbed up on the windowsill above and behind his shoulder, making him twist awkwardly.
Do we have a deal?
But the hand was ignoring him. It had suddenly lost all interest in bargain-making. If it had possessed a nose, it would have been sniffing the air. In the space of the last few moments, things had changed. The deal was off.
What are you doing?
The glass was dirty on the inside and caked with several years of bird droppings on the outside, but he could just see a garden through it down below. Its few trees were either dead or bowed under the weight of unpruned branches. The borders were rife with weeds, the benches on their backs with their square legs in the air. Only the lawn was kept mowed, a small concession to care. Somebody, a doctor taking a moment out for a quiet smoke, was wandering among the strangled walks. Otherwise, the garden was empty.
You want to go out?
If he denied its demands, it could hurt him. If he acquiesced to it and tried to get out into the garden, what might he find? On the other hand, what choice did he have?
All right. Okay. All right, we're going.
What the hell is this? Some kind of suicide dealer? What?
Yeah, it starts moving in a hole.
Just send over as many units as you can spare, all right, please?
The grass was dew damp underfoot, and here in the shadow of the seven-story hospital wing, it was cold. Charlie's hand was in ecstasy now. It was sweating so much it dripped, and all the blood left it, so that it had paled to white. It didn't belong to him anymore. It was another being to which he, by some unfortunate quirk of anatomy, was attached. He would be delighted to be rid of it. As he wandered farther down the garden, he noticed footprints darker on the silver-green lawn. Just as he arrived at the tree, the grass turned red. He realized that the prints led one way only. Charlie looked up into the branches. The dead tree had borne two amazing kinds of fruit.
Oh, my God.
One was a human being, the surgeon with the cigarette. He was dead, his neck lodged in a cleft where two branches met. He had no hands. His arms ended in round wounds that still drained heavy clots of brilliant color down onto the grass. Above his head, the tree swarmed with that other fruit, more unnatural still. All shades and shapes, a manual parliament in session. Charlie wanted to run, but his right hand was having none of it. These were its disciples, gathered here in such abundance, and they awaited its parables and its prophecies. Charlie looked at the dead doctor, and then at his murdering hands, and thought of Ellen. His Ellen, killed through no fault of his own, and already cold. They'd pay for that crime, all of them. As long as his body still did him service, he'd make them pay. It was cowardice trying to bargain with this cancer at his wrist. He saw that now. It and its like were a pestilence. They had no place living. They sensed the Messiah's presence. In a few moments, Charlie knew they would be swarming all over him and all advantage would be lost. He turned away from the tree before his right hand could seize a branch and looked up at the Cheney Memorial Wing, seeking inspiration. It loomed over the garden, windows blinded by the sky, doors closed. There was no solace there.
They've been looking for you, haven't they? They need you. You started it all, didn't you?
The hand did not deign to answer now, not when triumph was so near. Of course they would come, Charlie realized. Where he led, they would come. Perhaps their blind adoration of his remaining hand was an exploitable weakness. Now his eye picked out the fire escape. It zigzagged up the side of the building to the roof.
Yes, you'll pay. All of you. Every one.
A crop of fresh red flowers was carpeting the ground at the bottom of the fire escape, spreading up the stairs. They were coming in their hungry hundreds, all nails and hatred.
Yes! I am your leader. Follow me. Follow me up!
It was too late now for understanding, Charlie knew. Others would have to piece it together for themselves. What a fine jigsaw it would make. Maybe someone would turn up some plausible solution, an explanation for this uprising that he had not found, but he doubted it. Corpses of pigeons lay in puddles on the gravel-lined roof. Near where he fell, a bucket marked soiled dressings lay on its side, its contents green. He stared across this wilderness to the other side. Nonsense filled his head in place of coherent thought. A cone, a Buddhist riddle he had seen on the cover of a book once, was itching in his memory.
What is the sound? What is the sound?
He couldn't complete the phrase, try as he might.
What is the sound?
He almost fell against the parapet at the opposite side of the roof. Staring over it, he could see a straight fall, down to a parking lot below, at the front of the building. It was deserted. He leaned over further, and drops of his blood fell from his lacerated neck, diminishing quickly, down, down, to wet the ground. I'm coming, he said to gravity and to Ellen, and thought how good it would be to die, and never worry again if his gums bled when he brushed his teeth, or his waistline swelled, or some beauty passed him on the street whose lips he wanted to kiss and never would.
Yes, you can come. You can come wherever I go.
They obscured his body from head to foot, witless in their enthusiasm, ecstatic.
What is the sound?
Oh, yes. Now it came to him. What is the sound? Of one hand clapping. It was so satisfying to remember something you were trying so hard to dig up out of your subconscious, like finding some trinket you'd thought you'd lost forever. The thrill of remembering sweetened his last moments. He pitched himself into empty space, falling over and over, until there was an end to dental hygiene and the beauty of young women. And they came after, throwing themselves to their deaths in pursuit of their Messiah. It was a rare spectacle, horrible, unforgettable to the patients and nurses and doctors who witnessed from the windows of the hospital. But there was no significance to be discovered in it, merely the paraphernalia of a minor apocalypse. Nothing to be done but clear it up, their own hands reluctantly compliant as the corpses were cataloged for further examination. A few of those involved in the operation found a private moment in which to pray for explanations, or at least for dreamless sleep. Even the smattering of agnostics on the staff were surprised how easy it was to put palm to palm.
Uh.
Boswell pressed the call signal again, but there were bells ringing everywhere in the building, and nobody seemed to be answering them. It was a private room in intensive care, but somebody was in the room with him, hiding behind the screen in the corner. He heard the shuffling of the intruder's feet. No one answered his call. Using the cabinet beside him for leverage, he hauled himself to the edge of his bed to get a better view of this joker.
Who's there? Who's it? I know you're there. Come out. Who are you? Come out. Hey.
He could just about see him now. He pulled himself a little farther, and somehow all at once he realized that his center of balance had radically altered, that he had no legs. His bloodshot eyes scanned the room and came to rest on the naked feet that were now a yard from his nose. A tag around the ankle marked them for the furnace. He looked up, and they were his legs, standing there severed between the groin and knee, but still alive and kicking. For a moment he thought they intended to do him harm, but no. Having made their presence known to him, they left him where he lay, content to be free. And did his eyes envy their liberty, he wondered, and was his tongue eager to be out of his mouth and away, and was every part of him in its subtle way preparing to forsake him? He was an alliance only held together by the most tenuous of truces. Now, with the precedent set, how long before the next uprising? Minutes? Years? He waited, heart in mouth, for the fall of the Empire.
Body Politic by Clive Barker was produced by Malou's Honor. Coordinating producer Suzanne Rosencrantz. Technical director Gary Fink. Dramatization director Dan Bunnell. Audio adaptation Dan Canoy. Original music by Carl Schurz. The performers were Steve Simpson, Monica Merriman, Michael Patrick King, Josh Pice, Mark Margolis, and Peter Saputo. Mixed at MRC Studios. Also available in 3D sound from Simon & Schuster, The Mist by Stephen King. If you would like more information on other Simon & Schuster audio programs, please write to us at the address printed on the package.